Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Book reviewer Dan Barnett says local author Brian T. Marshall's novel Fleet is so well written, it could not be out of place on a national bestseller list. I'll be talking to the author of this mystery novel later in the hour. My first guest writes books for young people that adults enjoy. Her book, John and Annie Bidwell, The Long and Short of It, is illustrated by Steve Fershad, who also did the cover illustration for Brian Marshall's book. My guest today is a graduate of UC Berkeley and a former librarian who became fascinated with Butte County history when she worked as a reference librarian at the Chico Branch Library. Nancy Leek is the author of a biography for young readers about California pioneer John Bidwell, and she serves on the board of the Bidwell Mansion Association in Chico. She has now written a picture book that is historically accurate about John and his wife Annie Bidwell, with kid-friendly illustrations by Steve Fershad. Steve has illustrated over 30 books and has won awards for The Carpenter's Legacy and The Man Who Spoke to Cats. Steve and Nancy collaborated on this new book, John and Annie Bidwell, The Long and the Short of It. Steve Fershad and Nancy Leek, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
Now, when you were doing the illustrations for this book, Steve,
yes,
there was a page where you had a couple of pages where you illustrated distinguished guests that came to visit the Bidwells,
yes,
once they had their mansion built. And one of them was somebody that is not well known here now. He's not a big figure like, I mean, the Bidwells had presidents come visit and distinguished people that we've heard of. But there was a guy who people may be scratching their heads, say, Press Longley? Who was that?
Yeah, when Nancy gave me these names of the people that wanted to be showing as guests at the mansion, a lot of them I'm recognizing. I didn't recognize that name. So I Googled it, and I just found a picture of him. And one of the worst things you
which
can do—
Which is all you needed, really.
Which is all I needed. But one of the worst things about Googling something, you start becoming fascinated with a story. So you just have to learn to move on, or you just get stuck in that thing.
You're wanting to read about this.
Wanting to read about this man. I did not read about him. But like as going through all of Nancy's book, I realized how much I did not know about John Bidwell.
Yeah, and yet he's such a familiar face even here in Chico. We see his picture painted on a mural, and we're so familiar with the name. I mean, Bidwell Park and
yes,
Bidwell Mansion, and so we think we know a lot about him, but there's so much we don't know. And that's why I think that this book that you and Nancy have created will not just be of interest to youngsters, but I think it's a nice, concise way of introducing the story of John and Annie Bidwell to those of us who live in this area.
Yeah, like I said, I was totally ignorant about John Bidwell until I read this book. So you made a good point. It's also good for an adult. Me being an adult, I found the thing fascinating.
Well, one reason I focused when I got to that page with your illustration of Press Longley,
yes,
I thought, oh, I know who he is because I read the book that Nancy did before mm-hmm. this book that she worked with you. And that's a book called The Minor Poet, and these collection of poems by Press Longley, which you might not have known he was a poet.
No, I was completely ignorant about him, to be honest.
So because, and this is a book that Nancy collaborated with another person, and because he is such an interesting person, Nancy, I want you to tell us about the research that went into your previous book called The Minor Poet, The Poems of Press Longley. And these were edited by?
By John Rutterow, mainly, and then myself. I gave him a little bit of help. Mainly it's John's book. I couldn't resist putting Press Longley in that spread. Now, he's not as prominent a person as General Sherman or John Muir or Susan B. Anthony, but like those famous people, he was a friend of the Bidwells, and he was a Butte County man. He came with the gold rush. He was one of that, you know, horde of miners who lived on. For 60 years, he wrote poems and reports from the mountains, too, for newspapers. But mainly, you know, he wrote these poems that were published in newspapers, and John Rutterow collected those poems by going back through the microfilm because they're, other than one little pamphlet, there's no collection of Press's poems. But he's a fun poet. He did all kinds of different things. He did sentimental verse and martial verse and narrative and satiric and humorous and tributes to pretty girls. And he wrote one about Rancho Chico as a tribute to the Bidwells. He visited their home frequently. And he met Annie's father, Joseph Kennedy, who asked him, does poetry pay? And Press says, does poetry pay? Not in dollars or cents, but it must be inferred it has some recompense.
That's what Garrison Keillor likes to make fun of English majors, that he would say, no, poetry doesn't pay, but he's not as clever as in some aspects.
I think Press mainly got paid in pies and things like that. He would write you an obituary on your dog.
Well, you know what I find interesting, too? You say that Press Longley and John Bidwell got to be friends because at first, when John Bidwell, being the biggest employer here in the area, was contacted by Press Longley. Press Longley wanted a job.
He was always looking for, once the mining ran out, you know.
And he was qualified for it, but Bidwell turned him down.
And Press was a staunch Democrat and from Tennessee. And this was in the 1860s. Bidwell, by now, was a Republican. We don't really know. But he may have thought Press was a Southern sympathizer, and he didn't have any truck with them. So,
and since you told us, you tell us that he was born in Tennessee, and you tell us about he might have been a Southern sympathizer. So that adds another dimension for me. I can imagine this poet with a Southern accent. Mm. Just like Steve pictures, it takes a photograph and sketches this man and shows us what he looks like. And I fill out the picture with, besides being a clever poet, with his maybe reciting his poetry in with a Southern accent.
Yeah, probably.
Now, the first poem, because in this book that you and John Rutterow put together, the poems are in chronological order except the first one. And this was because I think Press himself put this poem first in a collection.
In the little pamphlet that has only a few poems in it, yes, true poets are prophets was sort of his theme.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to read the first verse of that. True poets are prophets. This is a poem that Press Longley wrote in 1890. I hold that true poets are prophets whose voices are echoes sublime, whose songs are the anthems of nations that float down the river of time. Their beautiful songs are immortal. They shall live when the mountains decay and be sung when earth's glorious temples have passed like the shadows away. So Press Longley realizes that poems last longer than the poet himself.
And it's nice to bring him back to life in this collection. It, you know, it has 100 of his poems. They're really a window into the lives and concerns of the people of that day. And I'm glad we brought him back.
Yeah, and I'm glad you did too, because this is what he wanted. This was a dream of his.
Yes, it was.
And it didn't come true until you made it come true.
Yeah, so I hope Press is happy there somewhere.
Yeah, this it's been over 100 years.
Yes.
But finally, there's a collection of Press Longley's poems in print. So I might remind readers that the book we're talking about at the moment is The Minor Poet, The Poems of Press Longley, edited by John Rutterow and Nancy Leek. And The Minor Poet, most people are probably, it's in their head thinking M-I-N-O-R, because he's not a huge poet, he's a minor poet.
He was both.
But he's also an M-I-N-E-R poet.
Definitely. He lived up Butte Creek Canyon, at a place called Boneyard Flat, where he had a cabin. And when the cabin burned down in, I think, 1906, he lost all his papers, he lost all his poems. He had to, when he wanted to send them to the state library, which he did, he had to collect them back from friends who had put them in scrapbooks and so forth, because they were only printed in the newspaper. They were rather ephemeral.
Yeah. So, and when his cabin burned down, and you say it was 1906, there went his poems. Yeah. So he had to try to collect them again. Now, you mentioned where he lived, and in those days, men outnumbered women. So a guy,
by far, yes.
So a guy was lucky to find a wife. And it took Press Longley a long time. By the way, Press is short for Preston. His name was Alexander Preston Longley.
Yes, he always went by Press.
How old was he when he got married? Do you remember?
He was 50-something.
Yeah, he was 58.
58.
So he gets married.
It didn't last long.
And it didn't last.
Yeah, they both decided they'd made a mistake and went their separate ways.
Yeah, so you mentioned where he lived, and she didn't like that, and she wasn't interested in his writing.
He must have been a charming man, because he charmed her. I think he was probably a charming, sociable man, but not the greatest husband, maybe.
Well, you know why I think women would like him, present-day women and women of that era, is this is something that he wrote. "We turn to the ladies, God bless their dear souls. I hope they'll get ballots and march to the polls. In short, she is worthy of every trust. To vote her own ballot, she shall and she must."
Yes, he was a supporter of women's suffrage. And those lines come from a lengthy 4th of July poem. Back in the day, at a 4th of July celebration, you not only had big speeches and the band and all of that, but you had a poet who would come with some original lines to read for, and it wasn't short either.
No, I notice there's some dots there, some ellipses. Well, you know, I find this so interesting to see the times through the eyes of the person who was alive then, rather than a history book that we have to kind of construct, well, here's how they must have felt. For example, he didn't like Leland Stanford.
No.
And what he wrote was, "They sold our sacred birthright. They left us in the cold. And now they ought to hang themselves as Judas did of old." Woof. I'm watching Steve's reaction because this is new to him.
Yeah.
But those are pretty strong words.
Those are. Those are incredible, actually.
So you might want to do a book about Press Longlin and illustrate it, what a character he is. But he was, I think I would have really liked him. He was a Renaissance man.
Too.
Yeah, he was a dreamer. And he loved California. And he had such a wide variety of styles of poetry. I really enjoyed the poetry that you and John Rutterow collected in this book.
Yeah, they always rhyme. They have a nice regular meter. They're very 19th century. But they're on a lot of different themes. Mm-hmm. And quite a few of them are humorous. Very enjoyable.
Well, I do have one quote from him because he taught. He was also a teacher before he came to California. He was a teacher. He and his family moved to Texas, where his brother was. And in Austin, Texas, he took up teaching again. But here's a quote. Quote, "Teaching the juvenile undergrowth how to vegetate was unrewarding," and he soon gave it up.
Yeah, so he went and joined the Texas Rangers.
Yeah, he said, "Teaching the juvenile undergrowth how to vegetate."
Yeah.
Kind of could apply to today, couldn't it?
That's what I'm thinking. You know, the way he was presenting his thoughts, we could say, wow, that could have been written yesterday.
Yeah.
So he wrote for the Sacramento. His poems were published in the Sacramento Bee, the San Francisco Examiner, a literary magazine. So he may have been a minor poet in some people's eyes, but I think if people were to read his poems, they would really enjoy them.
I think so, too.
And we can just imagine how pleased he is that after 100 years, you, Nancy Leake, and John Rutterow brought his poems, collected them, and put them in a book. However, now that we know who Press Longley is on one of the pages of the book, I want to ask Steve how you, Nancy, and he... I'm sure, Nancy, it must have been your idea because you love Butte County history. And Steve illustrates for all sorts of, you know, children's books and fairy tales and all sorts of genres.
I wanted to do a picture book biography, something easier for the third graders.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that this is your idea and you said, but if it's a children's book, it needs some good pictures in it.
Absolutely.
And I'm guessing that that's when you contacted Steve.
That's right.
And then what did you need from Nancy, Steve?
Well, I originally liked to meet with them, especially local authors at Barnes & Noble. And then she hands me the manuscript, but before I even ask her to look in the children's section to see if there's a style that she likes. And she found the perfect book. It's about on Teddy Roosevelt. And so not that I copy the style, but I know what sort of look she's looking for to do the illustrations. And she sits and just tells me everything about John Bidwell, and I just sit there across from her with my mouth open. Just going,
we had long conversations about John Bidwell.
Yeah, hardly talked about the illustration. It was mostly just about all this stuff about John Bidwell, and so it was incredible. And like you said, it's even Press Longley. Mouth hung open when she's telling me all about him, you know.
Well, I would think that Nancy's part of it, because she has already written a book about John Bidwell, and she knows the history so well that she could sit down with her eyes closed and write this out in a shorter time than it takes you. I mean, this, there's so many illustrations in this book. This must have taken you a very long time.
Yes, longer than it should. When Nancy first contacted me, my dad just died, so I had to take care of all the things. And she was so patient, because my dad was a bit of a hoarder, and it took forever to clean up his place. But she was so patient, but I always look forward to meeting with her, because, like I said, there was not one question she couldn't answer. And so she was never, let me get back to you on that. She just knew it right away.
Knew right away what she wanted.
Yeah.
He's actually a very quick illustrator. He can, he works very fast. But he had his own personal delays,
yeah,
and that kept it hanging fire for some months. But I'm really happy it's all done now. I think he did a great job.
Well, even if he actually, the actual sketch doesn't take long, the preparation of saying, okay, what do I want in this scene? Who are the people that are going to be in here?
Yes.
I would think that part of it, the conception, takes a lot. And he might be able to sketch it quickly once he decides, but he needs to come up with
how, and it being this? In a historical book, everything had to be accurate.
That's right.
So because I was always sending him photographs,
yes,
of you know, bridges or the Rancho or whatever, you know, people. So
because
he has something to work with.
If somebody knows this history and they say, oh, look what he drew there. That's not right. You can't have that.
No, I had to find inkwells from back then and everything. So
You're mentioning that because I'm opening it to the first page and there's an inkwell. What did the inkwells look like then? What did a pen look like then?
Yes.
What is a picture frame? Here's a photograph of John and Annie. And you probably had an actual frame that you—
From that period, yeah.
From that period.
18th century frames, yes.
Yeah. So you have your sketches that are authentic. And there was one sketch illustration, Steve, where I wondered if you actually climbed up at the highest point in Bidwell Mansion, because there's a page where John and Annie are looking out at their property, which was quite extensive, and there's the mill. And I was thinking, I'll bet Steve actually crawled up there and looked out before he drew this illustration.
No. I never had the pleasure of going to the Tower of Bidwell Mansion. I just sort of had to imagine what it looked like. And Nancy actually supplied me with some great
photographs
and things of how it looked out in that area. So, and it was mostly farmland. It was actually incredible, just a few buildings, but a lot of farmland.
Looking from at that direction toward the mill would be toward the cemetery now in the avenues. If we'd done it from the other side, it would have showed the college or the town of Chico. Mm-hmm. But
my guests are Nancy Leek and Steve Fershad. Nancy wrote the story of John and Annie Bidwell, and Steve illustrated these lot taken from photographs. And the title is John and Annie Bidwell, The Long and the Short of It. And why did you select that title, Nancy?
Well, I am not good at coming up with titles. All I can think of is, okay, this is a book about John and Annie Bidwell. And a friend of mine suggested The Long and the Short of It, and I thought, oh, that's so corny.
But it's a children's book,
but
after
everybody
all.
I mentioned it to liked it. So I thought, yeah, you know, that is kind of cute, and it emphasizes the contrast between them, because he was very tall. I mean, he was 6 foot tall, which doesn't sound terrifically tall to us now, but in his day it was. He towered over everybody else. And she, of course, was only 4 foot eight. She was very tiny. There was that contrast. There were other contrasts between them. And there was 20 years difference in their ages. And when they first met, I mean, she liked him, but she was very hesitant to marry a man 20 years older.
Plus, he's from California, and she lived in Washington,
D.C. That was a long, long ways away. She was afraid she'd never see her family
again. He was a farmer.
They were very, very different people, but they fell deeply in love, and It's a lovely story.
Well, I might describe the cover of the book shows the two of them when they're younger, because mm-hmm. we're accustomed to seeing photographs of the older John and the older Annie.
I wanted to show them at how they would have looked about the time they got married, mm-hmm. rather than the old couple that we're used to.
And so stern-looking, but when you look at the young, they were actually a very good-looking couple when you look at their younger photographs.
Well, your illustration, they're quite handsome.
Yeah, well, thank you.
So we have John towering over Annie, and he has his hand on her shoulder, and she's rather fashionably dressed,
mm-hmm.
because after all, she was, her father was, he worked for the government, the federal government in Washington.
He was the head of the Census Bureau. Mm-hmm. He was a prominent man in Washington.
So that means she would have been accustomed to an active social life there in Washington. And here's this guy saying, Annie, come to California, this rather
It was
rough.
The back of beyond mm-hmm. then.
So they come out. John builds this mansion, and they have all these distinguished guests that come. And who are some of the other? We've talked about Press Longley, the poet.
Well, the most famous ones, of course, were President Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes. It was the first time that a sitting president had taken a tour of the Western states. And he came with General Sherman, who was probably even more famous than Hayes himself was. And they stayed at Bidwell Mansion on their way through California. And he took them to see the Cherokee mines and you know, his farm and everything. There was also Susan B. Anthony, although she doesn't come until after John has passed away, mm-hmm. to the mansion, mm-hmm. although I believe he was acquainted with her as well. She was mainly a friend of Annie's, of course. And the scientists, Sir Joseph Hooker and Asa Gray, and John Muir, of course, who was a great friend of the Bidwells. I think a lot of people don't realize that. He liked to visit them here. They went on camping trips together, and I'm particularly fond of the illustration of them on their camping trip because I love their tent. And Steve did a great little job with that scene.
In fact, I recognize that the photo because I've seen photographs of them in their
yes,
tent.
And it is
so when
based
I saw
that.
Steve's illustration, I recognized their tent. It's not like a little scout pup tent. It's a
miniature circus tent,
yeah,
it looks like. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a rather fancy tent for camping. My guests are Nancy Leek and Steve Fershad. Nancy wrote the story of John and Annie Bidwell, and Steve illustrated it. John and Annie Bidwell, the long and the short of it. But now when you start your story, Nancy, he hasn't met Annie just yet. And one thing that I liked, too, was that, and Steve, you drew a map mm-hmm. showing where John Bidwell came from when he came to California. And describe how you showed us where his trip, what you drew there.
Well, basically, it's based on the map that Nancy gave me. And we talked, and she's telling about all the problems they had along the way. So I tried to put there was a tornado there and just mm-hmm. Indians. And just when you actually look at it, you think of it just being a straight journey. But as you look at the map, it curves all over the place and through all these passes and along a river, right?
They always had to follow rivers, yeah.
Water, so it would be water mm-hmm. always available. And it was just incredible when you think about how we're so used to just driving 70 miles an hour down a highway, and here they are having...
And a straight shot on the interstate.
On the interstate, yeah.
And this map, because he starts his journey west in Missouri, but that's not where he was born. Nancy, tell us about where he was born.
He was born in New York State, near
which might
Chautauqua.
Surprise people.
Yeah. Then his family was a very typical American family. At the time, they were always moving westward. They moved from New York to Pennsylvania to Ohio to another place in Ohio. And then, you know, he studied at an academy. He was teaching school. He wanted to go out and see the West. And the West was the other side of the Mississippi at that time. So he went to Missouri, decided to settle down, lost his homestead to a claim jumper.
And you have an illustration of that,
yes.
This big, tough guy in your book, Steve. And so he says, well, I'll just go to California.
Yeah, he'd heard good things about California. People were starting to hear about, you know, the healthy climate and the fertile land. And even though it was part of Mexico at the time, they decided to give it a try.
And John Bidwell played a big role in the fact of California becoming a part of the United States instead of a part of Mexico.
Yes.
And how did they get the paperwork from Washington, D.C. to California?
That's a fun story. I mean, Bidwell was back at Washington, D.C. when the documents were signed admitting California to the Union. And he carried those papers on a steamship to the Isthmus of Panama and then up to – and nobody in California knows that they're a state yet. There was no telegraph. They had no way of knowing that their dream of being the 31st state had been accomplished. So he's on this steamship. He was also escorting the wife and daughter of a man named Elisha O. Crosby to California. And the young lady whose name was Miss Helen Crosby. And for some reason, he never says for sure why, but he had her hide the papers. She slept with them under her pillow. She rolled them up in her blue umbrella, when
which
they were,
Steve draws yes, in yes. the book. There's a picture of her blue umbrella, and yeah. we, the readers, think, oh, that's where the papers are.
Yeah, it's kind of a nice little sidelight. He was also
cloak
kind
and dagger. Yeah, cloak and dagger.
So Nancy Drewish. Yeah,
he was kind of hoping she'd take an interest in him too. He was kind of looking for a wife, but she went with his friend Major Hensley instead.
Well, another sketch you have, Steve, you drew the state of California to help us see, okay, there's Chico, there's Sutter's Farm, there's Sutter's Fort. Mm-hmm. And those of us who know the history of California know the importance of Sutter's Fort or the role that it played. And you have Fort Ross over there. And you say, and on this map, it says, during the Mexican War, he trained Mission Indians as soldiers. So he was all over the place.
At Mission San Luis Rey, mm-hmm. so yeah. he's way down south. Yeah, he was yeah. all over the state of California during the 40s especially.
So that gave him a chance to kind of scope it out and say, okay, where do I want to settle?
Yeah.
And so he picked this wonderful valley here where Chico is.
Loveliest of places, he said.
And his curiosity about, well, let's see, what will grow here? And what did he find?
Just about anything.
Just about anything. But it's interesting that that included grapes, and he marries a woman who says, no, no to alcohol. And so what did he do?
Well, he did grow grapes for raisins. Yeah. He kept that. The wine grapes got ripped out once he married Annie.
As a concession to his dear Annie. Yeah. So you you must have had a lot of fun, Steve, with these illustrations.
Oh,
this
it was
challenge.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Like I said, just the education even behind it. You
the
know.
Story.
Yes, it yeah. was fascinating.
You're learning the history mm-hmm. as you're drawing, and so you have to be quite accurate with your vision of this history.
Exactly, and how things did look. And one thing that was hard to was that back then, people didn't smile much in their photographs. And so to
well, get
they had
them, to sit there a long time.
A long
while
time.
Photog-
I mean, you know, I'm sure the holy yeah. grail of rare photographs is a picture of Susan B. Anthony smiling. You know, that's...
So you have to imagine, okay, here's what they would look like if they were actually smiling like they might
exactly, and what they were going through. You know, you sort of have to play that character as you're drawing it, you know.
Because you want it to appeal to children.
Yes.
Kid-friendly.
To show the personality of yeah. them, yeah.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you about your book that you collaborated on. My guests have been Nancy Leake, who wrote the book, and Steve Fershad, an award-winning illustrator. And their book is John and Annie Bidwell, The Long and the Short of It.
After a break, I'll be talking to author Brian T. Marshall, whose novel Fleet is part mystery and part literary thriller. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Brian T. Marshall is a graduate of UC Santa Cruz and for the past 20 years operated a small urban farm in Paradise with his wife. Recently, he moved to Magalia and devotes more time to literary and musical pursuits. He has now written a mystery novel called Fleet. Brian Marshall, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Well, you know, I opened your book and discovered that I'm fictitious.
Yeah, I had to put that. There's a disclaimer every book has that the characters are fictitious. I decided in this case we'd make the readers fictitious and the characters real.
Yeah, because it's a novel, and yet I open in the very first page, it says, everything in this book actually happened. All the people in it are real. However, you are fictitious, the
yeah,
reader.
You're probably the only one who've caught that so far, so congratulations.
Thank you. Well, you say
everything in this book actually happened and the people are real. And of course, that's, you're being ironic that that's not true. But these people that you create, that you say are real, that actually happened, are creations of your imagination. But they must, are any of them based on your experiences?
No, not really. I basically had a sense of who I wanted these people to be and what I wanted them to represent. I wanted an older man who was near the end of his journey in life, that was looking back on life and facing the loss of identity represented by Alzheimer's. And then I wanted a young woman who was just getting started on life, who was still searching for her own self and identity. And basically, in the course of the book, she finds a new self in a very dramatic way.
Well, I called your novel a mystery, and it doesn't exactly fit that category. On the back of your book, it says fiction slash contemporary fantasy.
Basically, it's a mix of genres, and the story had to be told from different approaches with different techniques and different voices and different flavors. So, yeah, it starts out about the first third is a mystery, and then you have a big reveal, and you find out who our mystery character is, and then at that point, it jumps into a whole other world.
Well, I was curious about your cover, because I'm looking at this cover that I mentioned, that Steve Fershad is the illustrator.
Great illustrator.
And he is, and he often illustrates children's books, but this is not a child on the cover of your book. Describe this cover. And you must have said, Steve, here's what I'd like, here's what I have in mind. And the two of you probably put your heads together and came up with this.
As I was writing a book, an image kept reappearing, the idea of a bird in a cage or the broken bird that needs to be healed. And when it came time to discuss the cover, I thought, well, we've got to like get that metaphor across to the reader. This person is a bird trapped in a cage. But in fact, it's a man who's in an enlarged bird cage. He's represented in the style of classic Greek artistic with the coloring and the black background. And as just a sheer coincidence, he's wearing an orange prison jumpsuit, which he does in the book, which is exactly the same shade that the Greeks used. So it was a really nice piece of serendipity there.
Yeah, it's very obvious. I mean, it captures that. Steve did a good job of capturing that imitation Greek motif. And you can tell right away, there's a Greek birdcage and a man is peering out from that birdcage. And he doesn't look real happy.
No, originally he was going to have a bird on his finger, but it made it look too whimsical. So we changed it. So he's looking at the reader with despair and longing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who will free him from his cage?
I'm talking to Brian Marshall, Brian T. Marshall. And he has written a book called Fleet. And would you like to explain the title? It's very short, concise.
It was a working title that I was going to change, but when I substituted a different title, several of my friends jumped on my back and said, go back to Fleet. If I say why I'm using it, it would reveal who the character is, the mystery man. So all I can say is if you actually do read the book, it will make sense in retrospect, I believe.
So we will, and you and I won't reveal all the mysteries.
Of course not. Of course, we're sworn to secrecy.
No, right. Well, you mentioned that your character has Alzheimer's, and what were the characteristics of Alzheimer's that you used? That he has a diagnosis. I'll say he has a diagnosis of Alzheimer's.
Right.
And so what clues do we have as a reader that, maybe he really does have Alzheimer's?
He's having a little bit of memory loss, but mainly for him, it's more mood swings. He's always been a loner, kind of an iconoclast, a very critical person, and suddenly finds his heart going out to this man who's brought into the police station off the streets. And no one can figure out why he cares, because he's not a warm human being. He's not compassionate. And all I can say is, well, when you get a diagnosis like this, things that didn't used to mean anything to you suddenly mean a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And he's identifying with this person who has no memory or identity, because that's pretty soon what he's going to be facing. So it creates a very strong bond between two total strangers.
Yeah, because when you say he has Alzheimer's, and I was expecting the memory loss, because that's predominantly what we think of when we think of Alzheimer's. And yet the mood swings are what come up. And in fact, that leads to a very interesting paragraph that I loved in your book, being somebody who loves words.
Okay.
And this, when you talk about the word snit, and you say snit, a good word, an English word with none of those harsh guttural consonants that had ridden in on the backs of the Germanic hordes so long ago, not as precious as the Gallic peak, as in something you might have a fit of, and not nearly as dramatic, as self-aggrandizing as the Latinate tantrum. So you go off on this word snit, which is a funny word in itself. And another time you mentioned the word amphora, and Simon is saying he liked the sound of that word.
Right.
And there's some words that capture me that way. I just think, like, the word snit, I think, is funny.
Yeah, Simon, I wanted, he's a linguist, so he's the person who decides what language this mysterious man in the beginning of the book is speaking. So he has to be a linguist by trade for a practical reason. But I thought, just in terms of having a fun character, he'd be great because as a writer, you get to explore words, what they mean, the nuances, the subtleties. And yeah, he was just really fun to be along for the ride.
Well, one thing I wondered about, this caused me to pause, is that on the back cover, it says, the retired linguist. And he's kind of taken leave as a professor. But I just wonder, does a linguist retire? I think he's still a linguist.
Well, he was a linguist before he knew what language was.
That's my point. You know, when he was 7 years old,
right,
he was fascinated with words. So I wondered about, well, yeah, he might be a retired professor, but I think he's still a linguist. In fact, Brian, if you don't mind, would you read that section where you say that on the day he, referring to Simon Patrick, your main character, on the day that he turned 7 years old, would you read that page for me?
Why, certainly. On the day that he turned 7 years old, Simon Patrick gave himself a gift. On that day, and every day that followed, he would learn a new word. For most people, especially those with seven candles on the cake, this would have sounded like a chore or a duty. But for Simon, it was a treat. Because for him, words were like candy, tiny little nuggets you popped in your mouth, only to find them expanding, exploding, engulfing you with new flavors, new worlds. His word for that day was precocious, and all day long he was precisely, exactly that.
My guest is Brian Marshall, and he's reading from his mystery novel, Fleet. And on the next page, you mentioned the word precocious. On the next page, the word that is highlighted is
serendipity.
Serendipity.
Which he explains is a word everyone knows what it means, but apparently it's one of those words that has absolutely no translatable cognate in other languages. So Simon loves the words that don't translate, the words that sit on the border between one culture and another. He finds those fascinating little doorways because you can't express yourself across them.
In fact, there are these very things that you're just talking about. Another language has a word for it that we don't. And I feel sometimes like I have handcuffs on when I'm talking to somebody who doesn't know that other language, and I want to use that word because it's exactly precisely what I want to express.
Right.
And yet I can't use it because they wouldn't know what I was talking
right.
about. And I have a friend who does exactly what Simon did when he was 7 years old. He, to this day, will come across an interesting word and make a note. And so he has this long list of words, just like Simon did
okay.
when he was a kid. And he and I have long discussions about words because we find them fascinating. My guest is Brian Marshall, and his character in his novel, Fleet, is, you mentioned, a linguist. And when I was reading your book, I first found out, okay, this college professor, his friend is a policeman. And I thought, oh, now that doesn't seem likely. That seems a little too unlikely. But then I find out what this policeman is like. And you describe Ben Carlson in your book as an anomaly, somebody who had not traded his soul in pursuit of a career, and that he was a kindred spirit with this college professor who is your main character.
Well, when I knew I'd had to have a New York PD officer, that you have the typical stereotype, someone street tough, single dimensional. And I wanted Ben Carlson, actually to have a conscience, have a compassion. He's the one who originally decides to befriend this prisoner in the cell. And so I thought it was really important to make him more multidimensional and also to give him a common bond with Simon. And Simon, one of the ways he got involved with the police department is when he initially moved to New York, rather than travel the world in search of new languages, he suddenly realized if he just started hanging around the precinct house and the courthouse, he would be able to pick up more languages than he ever had in his life because everyone in the world comes to New York. So it was in that capacity that he eventually became a friend of Ben Carlson.
Yeah, because that's what I wondered. Okay, so here's this professor and this policeman. How could they have their paths across? How could they have become friends? And then you answered it just as you did. And I found myself in that kind of situation where you don't know what language people are going to be speaking. You're in contact with people from all over the world. They could speak any language. And just a few weeks ago, there was this woman that I encountered, and we were kind of situation where I wanted to say, oh, just relax. You're not in my way, or your chair, your things on this chair are not bothering me. So I tried the languages I could think of to say, it's okay. And then she kept shaking her head very quietly, didn't say a word. I thought, well, this is strange. I don't know. She looks like maybe she speaks English, but she didn't say a word. Just then her friend walked up and started signing with her hands. Oh, and that's the language I would not have guessed.
Right. And yet, actually, when they're trying to figure out what language this prisoner is speaking, one of the languages they try is American Sign Language because, yeah, that's always a possibility they can't hear what you're saying.
And that surprised me because he tries all the languages that he might expect.
Right.
And then he is surprised at the language that Ben Carlson calls him in and meets this man. Ben does not know how to communicate with him. He calls in his friend who's a linguist and asks for his help. So describe that scene.
So Simon attempts to communicate with him through the bars of the prison cell. And the way he does it, he has this word he always uses, friend. So he starts in Bulgarian. Then he moves to Croatian. Then he slowly travels the Mediterranean in a circle. Eventually decides, well, it's getting a little chilly in here. Let's go somewhere sunnier. So he tries Greek. And after the first word, the man in the cell just lights up. The word connects with him. But then as they begin to exchange languages, their strange words start to infiltrate. And finally, Simon realizes this man in the prison cell is speaking Greek that has not been spoken for 3,000 years.
So he uses the word friend in the various languages that he knows, the translation of the word friend. But then I wondered, Ryan, he uses the word philos. And I wonder why you spelled it with an F instead of a PH.
Because when I contacted a Greek interpreter in Sacramento, they said with an F. So, yeah, I mean, it's always tricky because the Greek language, we're already...
And this is ancient Greek you're having your character speak.
Right. Yeah, so, and please, any speakers of ancient Greek out there, please do not get upset if I got it wrong.
Well, I wonder where you got it because you've reproduced some sentences in Greek.
Right. Originally, I used an online translator, but then when I prepared the book for publication, I went ahead and contacted someone down at Sacramento State, and they reviewed the little bit of in there and made a few corrections and suggestions.
And is that how you came up with the words in the other language for friend?
Yes, actually. So,
yeah. My guest is Brian Marshall, Brian T. Marshall, and we're talking about his book, Fleet, that is part mystery. Part, you said it crosses a lot of lines as far as genres go. However, what other descriptions do you have?
Well, it starts out more of a urban, almost police procedural, very quickly moves into the mystery of who this man who's brought in off the streets is. Then about a third of the way through, his true identity is revealed, at which point it becomes more of a contemporary urban fantasy. And then hopefully it has its literary elements in terms of the depth of the characterization and some of the passages and descriptive. I wanted to make sure it wasn't just a fast-paced story, that it had a little bit more depth and nuance to it.
Well, speaking of that, I'd like to go to the part of your book where your policeman, Ben, has a flashback. And would you read that section in your book?
This is flashing back to a day 30 years in the past when he had been on a sailing trip on the coast outside of Seattle. And then day 4 rolled around. Somehow he felt it, asleep below decks, reaching right into his dreams. A change. He lay there a minute, listening to the heavy sounds of the others breathing, feeling the slight bob of ship on water, and then quietly slid from the bunk. 7 wooden rungs, a quick tug on the sliding hatch door, and then he was outside, on the deck. Or was he? Overnight, without warning, the fog had crept in. But that word, fog, just didn't cut it. Didn't begin to describe the pale gray blanket, the pall that had descended on the world. Staring ahead, he saw no railing. Both masts had disappeared. Even his hand, held at arm's length, was a phantom, barely there. Turning his head, softly spinning, he could detect no sun, no place in the sky that was lighter or darker, east or west. And when he reached out, found the rail, and then peered beyond it, he saw the horizon had deserted him as well, that there is no line, no demarcation between sky and sea, between one gray and the next. Suddenly his heart began to pound. His breath quickened. Part of him knew it was only fog, water droplets suspended in air, and that beyond the mist lay the same rocky coast, solid and substantial, and somewhere beyond that, his home, his family, the people he knew and loved. But another part of him knew that was a lie, that somehow all those things had been taken away. Or no, even worse, that they'd never been there to begin with, that the real world, the world we refused to see, was just this, gray mist and nothing more. Like that strange place, limbo, they terrified him with as a child. A place that was waiting for you once you were dead. Vast and eternal, empty and timeless, stretching on forevermore.
My guest is Brian T. Marshall, and he's just read from his novel, Fleet. And the section he was reading was a flashback from one of the characters, Ben Carlson, who plays a role of a policeman. And later you give clues to that section there, this description of his flashback. And also you mention his children, his two kids, aren't just on the street with some menial jobs. They're, you got one's the daughter at Stanford.
One at MIT.
And one at MIT. So we reach the conclusion that this guy's pretty sharp.
Right. Even though he tries to hide it as well as possible, because when you're a New York cop, you don't want to seem too smart.
Yeah. Well, when you're talking about Simon, this professor, and his background, and I mentioned so many things that I could, this guy, it rings true for me because of my interest in words, and he even does field work in various places before he decides, oh, I don't need to be traveling over the world. I'll just find where, here in New York, where I can listen to people with foreign languages, and I do the same thing. In fact, I saw this woman, she looked Indian, and I asked her, what's your first language? I didn't ask her what country she was from, and she said, thank you for not asking that, because I was born in India, but I live in London.
Right.
And so but people were curious about her background, what language she spoke, so she was glad I did the word, asked that particular question. And then you say he did field work in Appalachia, and mentioned the porch sitters, because I spent some time in Appalachia, and that's true. The men in particular, the lady where I got my eggs and milk, she had cows and chickens, and I never saw her husband lift a finger. He sat on that porch.
It's a full-time job.
But that was his full-time. He occasionally answered the phone.
But. They're the cultural repositories of that entire world, and it's much the same way, like you meet the wise man in a village. That's the wise man of the Appalachian village.
And so when I read that, I thought, well, golly, maybe Brian spent some time there.
No, just picked it up in a book somewhere. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things when you're writing a book, things come up you didn't even know you knew, which is really fun because suddenly something will flash out and you realize, wow, where'd that come from? And I hope it's true. One thing I particularly liked, when there's a scene in a museum where they're examining the Greek statuary, and one of the characters says, it's really interesting. You think they're trying to be perfectly representational at first, but then you notice the head and the hands are a little bit larger in proportion to the rest of the body. And Sarah, the antiquity student, explains, well, that's because the Greek valued man's ability to create and to think above all others, the head and the hand. And this I totally made up out of cloth, but it sounded so perfect, I had to leave it in. And for all I know, it's like maybe someone is thinking, wow, that's a legitimate, you know, theory. And it just came to me. It was just such a great idea, I couldn't drop it. So.
Well, I've seen statues that are disproportionate because they're made to be located on a pedestal so high that from the ground, when you look up, the head would look too small.
Oh, okay. That's a great
one. And so the head is made larger to look in proportion from the viewer's point.
Yes. Oh, okay. Exactly. Perfect. Okay.
Exactly. Well, you mentioned, so we've talked about the character Simon Patrick, the professor. Now, there's another character that I would like you to... And you describe, and you get inside her head. This character is Sarah. Who is Sarah?
Sarah's an antiquity student. She's over from England. She's pursuing her doctorate at Columbia. She ends up signing on to help clean Simon's apartment a few days a week, and where she meets no man, the mysterious stranger with no past and no identity, and she kind of falls head over heels for him, but in a very restrained British way. And Sarah is a very interesting person. She's always felt kind of sidelined in life, always felt a little bit underappreciated, not real sure of herself. And so one of the journeys in the book is her journey towards becoming more fully herself.
Which we all hoped that we would do.
Yes.
So she is on this journey, and she, even though she's a housekeeper, she's not the usual housekeeper either. She's pretty sharp herself.
Right, and the fact that she knows about antiquity, she has a natural connection with this mysterious stranger who knows ancient Greek.
Well, why don't you read that section in your book?
Okay, here we go. This is a scene. She is sitting alone in a rented car parked by the side of the road. There's no noise, no traffic, not much of anything going on this late at night. Just her, her thoughts, and a dim splash of moonlight playing across the dash. She feels like a spy in a bad movie. Wonders if real spies feel the exact same way. Wonders if, by the time they film this one, she'll be too old to play herself. Not that anyone's around to notice. The camera, the audience doesn't care about her, the all-too-human driver. No, the focus is on them, hopping fences, disabling cameras, scurrying from one shadow to shadow. And not that she's resentful exactly, but she wonders if it's always been that way, always will be, with somebody else running the show, moving the story forward, while she fusses away in the background, adjusting the lights, checking the punctuation, sweeping up any stray sawdust. Sidekick. So where did that word come from, anyway? What exactly did it mean? And was there a place in heaven somewhere, a place where they all got together? Dr. Watson, Tonto, Robin, of course, 100 more she couldn't remember. Swapping stories, dishing dirt, all the little behind-the-scenes snafus that only a sidekick would know about. Because that was the only point in being one, as far as she could see. There wasn't much honor, even less glory. No paycheck, no pension, no dental. Just the knowledge that if push came to shove, you could ruin a brilliant career.
This is novelist Brian T. Marshall reading from his novel Fleet, one of the characters named Sarah Rhodes, who is the new housekeeper, also a student at Simons University. Now, you were reading about Sarah, and there's a section about that in the voice of Simon. And I would, if you would do me a favor, Brian, would you read those words in Simon's voice?
Well, I'll try my best, but it's rather embarrassing, but we'll give it a shot. A broken bird. Her pleading way gave... A broken bird. Her pleading look gave way to confusion. Sorry?
They're the most tempting thing in the world to some people. People like you and me.
She waited for him to go on.
So I wasn't much younger than you are now, my third year up at Cambridge. And there was this girl, Margaret Prescott. Back of the classroom, never said a word. Always wore the exact same thing. So you'd ask yourself, did she never change up? Or did she have a dresser back at the hall, stuffed with 7 white blouses and 7 plaid skirts, all of them identical, one for each day of the week? And back then, this being the Stone Age and all, girls were still a rarity on campus, and we should have been all over her, all us randy boys. But instead it was the exact opposite, that culling thing that every herd does, finding the weak one, the odd one, and shunting it away, leaving some predator to take care of the problem for them. Only in this case it wasn't some predator. It was me. Because, you see, I'd been just like her. An outcast, a cull. Only somehow a few years earlier I'd learned the trick, how to disguise myself, make the right sounds, carry the right scent. And I thought, seeing her, maybe I could pass it on, teach her the trick. He paused long enough to smile, at which point began the most terrible, wonderful, confusing, and generally bossed up year of my life.
This is Simon Patrick, a linguistics professor, Simon Patrick, reading the words of local writer Brian T. Marshall from,
wasn't that nice of
from
him?
Marshall's book, Fleet. I wish listeners could see your face. It transformed, Brian,
oh, really?
Into, I just believe you were actually British.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. That was marvelous. Well, we learn about this character who is working with this mystery guy that they've given the name No Man.
Right.
And we don't want to give away the fun, the mystery.
Right.
But I do want to thank you for coming in and introducing us to these characters and especially giving voice to Professor Patrick.
They hardly get over the house, so they really had a great opportunity to come out in the streets of Chico and get a little fun time.
Well, thank you. Again, the title of the book is Fleet, and the author is Brian T. Marshall. I would also like to thank my first guest, Nancy Leake, author of John and Annie Bidwell, The Long and Short of It. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.